trying to get everyday work done. The weekly review will also sharpen your intuitive focus on your important projects as you deal with the flood of new input and potential distractions coming at you the rest of the week. You're going to have to learn to say no, faster and to more things, in order to stay afloat and comfortable. Having some dedicated time in which to at least get up to the project level of thinking goes a long way toward making that easier. What is the weekly review? Very simply, the weekly review is whatever you need to do to get your head empty again. It's going through the five phases of workflow management, collecting, processing, organizing, and reviewing all your outstanding involvements until you can honestly say, I absolutely know right now everything I'm not doing but could be doing if I decided to. From a nitty-gritty, practical standpoint, here is the drill that can get you there. Loose papers. Pull out all miscellaneous scraps of paper, business cards, receipts, and so on that have crept into the crevices of your desk, clothing, and accessories. Put it all into your in-basket for processing. Process your notes. Review any journal entries, meeting notes, or miscellaneous notes scribbled on notebook paper. List action items, projects, waiting fors, calendar events, and someday maybes, as appropriate. File any reference notes and materials. Stage your read-review material. Be ruthless with yourself, processing all notes and thoughts relative to interactions, projects, new initiatives, and input that have come your way since your last download, and purging those not needed. Previous calendar data. Review past calendar dates in detail for remaining action items, reference information, and so on, and transfer that data into the active system. Be able to archive your last week's calendar with nothing left uncaptured. Upcoming calendar. Look at future calendar events, long and short term. Capture actions about arrangements and preparations for any upcoming events. Empty your head. Put in writing, in appropriate categories, any new projects, action items, waiting fors, someday maybes, and so forth that you haven't yet captured. Review projects and larger outcome lists. Evaluate the status of projects, goals, and outcomes one by one, ensuring that at least one current kickstart action for each is in your system. Review next actions lists. Mark off completed actions. Review for reminders of further action steps to capture. Review waiting for list. Record appropriate actions for any needed follow-up. Check off received items. Review any relevant checklist. Is there anything you haven't done that you need to do? Review someday maybe list. Check for any projects that may have become active and transfer them to projects. Delete items no longer of interest. Review pending and support files. Browse through all work-in-progress support material to trigger new actions, completions, and waiting fors. Be creative and courageous. Are there any new, wonderful, harebrained, creative, thought-provoking, risk-taking ideas you can add to your system? This review process is common sense, but few of us do it as well as we could, and that means as regularly as we should to keep a clear mind and a sense of relaxed control. The right time and place for the review. The weekly review is so critical that it behooves you to establish good habits, environments, and tools to support it. Once your comfort zone has been established for the kind of relaxed control that getting things done is all about, you won't have to worry too much about making yourself do the review. You'll have to do it to get back to your personal standards again. Until then, do whatever you need to once a week to trick yourself into backing away from the daily grind for at least a couple of hours, not to zone out, but to rise up at least to 10,000 feet and catch up. If you have the luxury of an office or workspace that can be somewhat isolated from the people and interactions of the day, and if you have anything resembling a typical Monday to Friday work week, I recommend that you block out 2 hours early every Friday afternoon for the review. Three factors make this an ideal time. First, the events of the week are likely to be still fresh enough for you to be able to do a complete postmortem. Oh yeah, I need to make sure I get back to her about, and so forth. Second, when you invariably uncover actions that require reaching people at work, you'll still have time to do that before they leave for the weekend. And third, it's great to clear your psychic decks so you can go into the weekend ready for refreshment and recreation with nothing on your mind. You may be the kind of person, however, who doesn't have normal weekends. I, for example, often have as much to do on Saturday and Sunday as on Wednesday. But I do have the questionable luxury of frequent long plane trips, which provide an ideal opportunity for me to catch up. A good friend and client of mine, an executive in the world's largest aerospace company, has his own Sunday night ritual of relaxing in his home office and processing the hundreds of notes he's generated during his week of back-to-back meetings. Whatever your lifestyle, you need a weekly regrouping ritual. You likely have something like this or close to it already. If so, leverage the habit by adding into it a higher altitude review process. The people who find it hardest to make time for this review are those who have constantly on-demand work and home environments with zero built-in time or space for regrouping. The most stressed professionals I have met are the ones who have to be mission-critically reactive at work, for example, high-level equities traders and chiefs of staff, and then go home to a couple of under 10-year-old children and a spouse who also works. The most fortunate of them have a one-hour train commute. If you recognize yourself in that picture, your greatest challenge will be to build in a consistent process of regrouping when your world is not directly in your face. You'll need to either accept the requirement of an after-hours time at your desk on a Friday night, or establish a relaxed but at-work kind of location and time at home. Executive Operational Review Time. I've coached many executives to block out 2 hours on their calendars on Fridays. For them, the biggest problem is how to balance quality thinking and catch-up time with the urgent demands of mission-critical interactions. This is a tough call. The most senior and savvy of them, however, know the value of sacrificing the seemingly urgent for the truly important, and they create their islands of time for some version of this process. Even the executives who have integrated a consistent reflective time in their work, though, often seem to give short shrift to the more mundane review and catch-up process at the 10,000-foot level. Between wall-to-wall meetings and ambling around your koi pond with a Chardonnay at sunset, there's got to be a slightly elevated level of reflection and regrouping required for operational control and focus. If you think you have all your open loops fully identified, clarified, assessed, and actionalized, you're probably kidding yourself. The bigger picture reviews. Yes, at some point, you must clarify the larger outcomes, the long-term goals, the visions and principles that ultimately drive and test your decisions. What are your key goals and objectives in your work? What should you have in place a year or 3 years from now? How is your career going? Is this the lifestyle that is most fulfilling to you? Are you doing what you really want or need to do from a deeper and longer-term perspective? The explicit focus of this book is not at those 30,000 to 50,000 plus foot levels. Urging you to operate from a higher perspective is, however, its implicit purpose, to assist you in making your total life expression more fulfilling and better aligned with the bigger game we're all about. As you increase the speed and agility with which you clear the runway and 10,000 foot levels of your life and work, be sure to revisit the other levels you're engaged in, now and then, to maintain a truly clear head. How often you ought to challenge yourself with that type of wide-ranging review is something only you can know. The principle I must affirm at this juncture is this. You need to assess your life and work at the appropriate horizons, making the appropriate decisions at the appropriate intervals in order to really come clean. Which brings us to the ultimate point and challenge of all this personal collecting, processing, organizing, and reviewing methodology. It's 9:22 a.m. Wednesday morning. What do you do? Chapter 9, Doing, Making the Best Action Choices. When it comes to your real-time, plow-through, get-it-done workday, how do you decide what to do at any given point? As I've said, my simple answer is trust your heart, or your spirit, Or if you're allergic to those kinds of words, try these: your gut, the seat of your pants, your intuition. That doesn't mean you throw your life to the winds, unless, of course, it does. I actually went down that route myself with some vengeance at one point in my life, and I can attest that the lessons were valuable, if not necessarily necessary. As outlined in Chapter 2, I have found three priority frameworks to be enormously helpful in the context of deciding actions. First, the four criterion model for choosing actions in the moment. Second, the threefold model for evaluating daily work. And third, the six-level model for reviewing your own work. These happen to be shown in reverse hierarchical order, that is, the reverse of the typical strategic top-down perspective. In keeping with the nature of the Getting Things Done methodology, I have found it useful to once again work from the bottom up, meaning I'll start with the most mundane levels. The four criteria model for choosing actions in the moment. Remember that you make your action choices based on the following four criteria in order. 1. Context. 2. Time available. 3. Energy available. 4. Priority. Let's examine each of these in the light of how you can best structure your systems and behaviors to take advantage of its dynamics. Context. At any point in time, the first thing to consider is, what could you possibly do where you are with the tools you have? Do you have a phone? Do you have access to the person you need to talk with face-to-face about three agenda items? Are you at the store where you need to buy something? If you can't do the action because you're not in the appropriate location or don't have the appropriate tool, don't worry about it. As I've said, you should always organize your action reminders by context. Calls, at home, at computer, errands, agenda for Joe, agenda for staff meeting, and so on. Since context is the first criterion that comes into play in your choice of actions, context-sorted lists prevent unnecessary reassessments about what to do. If you have a bunch of things to do on one to-do list, but you actually can't do many of them in the same context, you force yourself to continually keep reconsidering all of them. If you're stuck in traffic and the only actions you can take are calls on your cell phone, you want to be able to pull out just your calls list. Your action list should fold in or out based on what you could possibly do at any time. A second real benefit accrues from organizing all your actions by the physical context needed. That in itself forces you to make the all-important determination about the next physical action on your stuff. All of my action lists are set up this way, so I have to decide on the very next physical action before I can know which list to put an item on. Is this something that requires the computer, a phone, being in a store? People who give themselves a miscellaneous action list, that is, one not specific to a context, often let themselves slide in the next action decision, too. I frequently encourage clients to structure their list categories early on as they're processing their in-baskets, because that automatically grounds their projects in the real things that need to get done to get them moving. Time available. The second factor in choosing an action is how much time you have before you have to do something else. If your meeting is starting in 10 minutes, you'll most likely select a different action to do right now than you would if the next couple of hours were clear. Obviously, it's good to know how much time you have at hand, hence the emphasis on calendar and watch. A total life action reminder inventory will give you maximum information about what you need to do and make it much easier to match your actions to the windows you have. In other words, if you have 10 minutes before that next meeting, find a 10-minute thing to do. If your lists have only the big or important things on them, no item listed may be possible to handle in a 10-minute period. If you're going to have to do those shorter action item things anyway, the most productive way to get them done is to utilize the little weird time windows that occur throughout the day. Energy available. Although you can increase your energy level at times by changing your context and redirecting your focus, you can do only so much. The tail end of a day taken up mostly by a marathon budget planning session is probably not the best time to call a prospective client or start drafting a performance review policy. It might be better to call the airline to change a reservation, process some expense receipts, or skim a trade journal. Just as having all your next action options available allows you to take advantage of various time slots, Knowing about everything you're going to need to process and do at some point will allow you to match productive activity with your vitality level. I recommend that you always keep an inventory of things that need to be done that require very little mental or creative horsepower. When you're in one of those low energy states, do them. Casual reading, magazines, articles, and catalogs, telephone address data that need to be inputted onto your computer, file purging, backing up your laptop, even just watering your plants and filling your stapler. These are some of the myriad things that you've got to deal with sometime anyway. This is one of the best reasons for having very clean edges to your personal management system. It makes it easy to continue doing productive activity when you're not in top form. If you're in a low energy mode and your reading material is disorganized, your receipts are all over the place, your filing system is chaotic, and your in-basket is dysfunctional, it just seems like too much work to do to find and organize the tasks at hand. So you simply avoid doing anything at all, and then you feel even worse. One of the best ways to increase your energy is to close some of your loops. So always be sure to have some easy loops to close right at hand. These first three criteria for choosing action, context, time, and energy, bespeak the need for a complete next action reminder system. Sometimes you won't be in a mode to do that kind of thinking. It needs to have already been done. If it is, you can operate much more in your zone and choose from delineated actions that fit the situation. Priority. Given the context you're in and the time and energy you have, the obvious next criterion for action choice is relative priority. Out of all my remaining options, what is the most important thing for me to do? How do I decide my priorities? Is a question I frequently hear from people I'm working with. It springs from their experience of having more on their plate to do than they can comfortably handle. They know that some hard choices have to be made, and that some things may not get done at all. At the end of the day, in order to feel good about what you didn't get done, you must have made some conscious decisions about your responsibilities, goals, and values. That process invariably includes an often complex interplay with the goals, values, and directions of your organization and of the other significant people in your life, and with the importance of those relationships to you. The threefold model for evaluating daily work. Setting priorities assumes that some things will be more important than others, but important relative to what? In this context, the answer is to your work, that is, the job you have accepted from yourself and/or from others. This is where the next two frameworks need to be brought to bear in your thinking. They're about defining your work. Keep in mind that though much of this methodology will be within the arena of your professional focus, I'm using work in the universal sense to mean anything you have a commitment to making happen, personally as well as professionally. These days, daily work activity itself presents a relatively new type of challenge to most professionals, something that it's helpful to understand as we endeavor to build the most productive systems. As I explained earlier, during the course of the workday, at any point in time, you'll be engaged in one of three types of activities: doing predefined work, doing work as it shows up, and defining your work. You may be doing things on your action lists, doing things as they come up, or processing incoming inputs to determine what work that needs to be done, either then or later, from your lists. This is common sense. But many people let themselves get wrapped around the second activity, dealing with things that show up ad hoc, much too easily, and let the other two slide to their detriment. Let's say it's 10:26 a.m. Monday, and you're in your office. You've just ended a half-hour unexpected phone call with a prospective client. You have 3 pages of scribbled notes from the conversation. There's a meeting scheduled with your staff at 11, about half an hour from now. You were out late last night with your spouse's parents and are still a little frayed around the edges. You told your father-in-law you'd get back to him about what? Your assistant just laid 6 telephone messages in front of you. You have a major strategic planning session coming up in 2 days for which you have yet to formulate your ideas. The oil light in your car came on as you drove to work this morning, and your boss hinted, as you passed her earlier in the hall, that she'd like your thoughts on the memo she emailed you yesterday before this afternoon's 3 o'clock meeting. Are your systems set up to maximally support dealing with this reality at 10:26 on Monday morning? If you're still keeping things in your head, And if you're still trying to capture only the critical stuff on your lists, I suggest the answer is no. I've noticed that people are actually more comfortable dealing with surprises and crises than they are taking control of processing, organizing, reviewing, and assessing that part of their work that is not as self-evident. It's easy to get sucked into busy and urgent mode, especially when you have a lot of unprocessed and relatively out-of-control work on your desk, in your email, and on your mind. In fact, much of our life and work just shows up in the moment, and it usually becomes the priority when it does. It's indeed true for most professionals that the nature of their job requires them to be instantly available to handle new work as it appears in many forms. For instance, you need to pay attention to your boss when he shows up and wants a few minutes of your time. You get a request from a senior executive that suddenly takes precedence over anything else you thought you needed to do today. You find out about a serious problem with fulfilling a major customer's order, and you have to take care of it right away. These are all understandable judgment calls. But the angst begins to mount when the other actions on your list are not reviewed and renegotiated by you or between you and everyone else. The constant sacrifices of not doing the work you've defined on your list can be tolerated only if you know what you're not doing. That requires regular processing of your in-basket, defining your work, and consistent review of complete lists of all your predetermined work. If choosing to do work that just showed up instead of doing work you predefined is a conscious choice based on your best call, that's playing the game the best way you can. Most people, however, have major improvements to make in how they clarify, manage, and renegotiate their total inventory of projects and actions. If you let yourself get caught up in the urgencies of the moment without feeling comfortable about what you're not dealing with, the result is frustration and anxiety. Too often, the stress and lowered effectiveness are blamed on the surprises. If you know what you're doing and what you're not doing, surprises are just another opportunity to be creative and excel. In addition, when the in-basket and the action lists get ignored for too long, random things lying in them tend to surface as emergencies later on, adding more ad hoc work as it shows up to fuel the fire. Many people use the inevitability of an almost infinite stream of immediately evident things to do as a way to avoid the responsibilities of defining their work and managing their total inventory. It's easy to get seduced into not quite so critical stuff that is right at hand, especially if your in-basket and your personal organization are out of control. Too often, managing by wandering around is an excuse for getting away from amorphous piles of stuff. This is where the need for knowledge work athletics really shows up. Most people did not grow up in a world where defining the edges of work and managing huge numbers of open loops were required. But when you've developed the skill and habits of processing input rapidly into a rigorously defined system, it becomes much easier to trust your judgment calls about the dance of what to do, what to stop doing, and what to do instead. The moment-to-moment balancing act. At the black belt level, you can shift like lightning from one foot to the other and back again. While you're processing your in-basket, for example, your assistant comes in and tells you about a situation that needs immediate attention. No sweat, your tray is still there, with everything still to be processed in one stack, ready to be picked up again when you can get back to it. While you're on hold on the phone, you can be reviewing your action list and getting a sense of what you're going to do when the call is done. While you wait for a meeting to start, you can work down the read-review stack you've brought with you. And when the conversation you weren't expecting with your boss shrinks the time you have before your next meeting to 12 minutes, you can easily find a way to use that window to good advantage. You can do only one of these work activities at a time. If you stop to talk to someone in his or her office, you're not working off your list or processing incoming stuff. The challenge is to feel confident about what you have decided to do. So, how do you decide? This again will involve your intuitive judgments. How important is the unexpected work against all the rest? How long can you let your in-basket go unprocessed and all your stuff unreviewed and trust that you're making good decisions about what to do? People often complain about the interruptions that prevent them from doing their work. But interruptions are unavoidable in life. When you become elegant at dispatching what's coming in, and are organized enough to take advantage of the weird time windows that show up, you can switch between one task and the other rapidly. You can be processing emails while you're on hold on a conference call. But you must learn to dance among many tasks to keep a healthy balance of your workflow. Your choices will still have to be calibrated against your own clarity about the nature and goals of your work. Your ability to deal with surprise is your competitive edge. But at a certain point, if you're not catching up and getting things under control, staying busy with only the work at hand will undermine your effectiveness. And ultimately, in order to know whether you should stop what you are doing and do something else, you'll need to have a good sense of what your job requires and how that fits into the other contexts of your life. The only way you can have that is to evaluate your life and work appropriately at multiple horizons. The six-level model for reviewing your own work. The six levels of work you'll recall from Chapter 2 may be thought of in terms of altitude, 50,000 plus feet, life, 40,000 feet, 3 to 5 year visions, 30,000 feet, 1 to 2 year goals, 20,000 feet, areas of responsibility, 10,000 feet, current projects, runway, current actions. It makes sense that each of these levels should enhance and align with the ones above it. In other words, your priorities will sit in a hierarchy from the top down. Ultimately, if the phone call you're supposed to make clashes with your life purpose or values, to be in sync with yourself, you won't make it. If your job structure doesn't match up with where you need to be a year from now, you should rethink how you've framed your areas of focus and responsibilities if you want to get where you're going most efficiently. Let's look at that first example from the bottom up. The phone call you need to make, action, is about the deal you're working on, project, which would increase sales, responsibility. This particular deal would give you the opportunity to move up in the sales force, job goal, because of the new market your company wants to penetrate, organization vision, and that would get you closer to the way you want to be living, both financially and professionally, life. Or, from the other direction, you've decided that you want to be your own boss and unlock some of your unique assets and talents in a particular area that resonates with you, life, so you create a business for yourself, vision, with some short-term key operational objectives, job goal. That gives you some critical roles you need to fulfill to get it rolling, responsibility, with some immediate outcomes to achieve, projects. On each of these projects, you'll have things you need to do as soon as you can do them, next actions. The healthiest approach for relaxed control and inspired productivity is to manage all the levels in a balanced fashion. At any of these levels, it's critical to identify all the open loops, all the incompletions, and all the commitments that you have right now as best you can. Without an acceptance and an objective assessment of what's true in the present, it's always difficult to cast off for new shores. What's on your answering machine? What are your projects relative to your kids? What are you responsible for in the office? What's pushing on you to change or attracting you to create in the next months or years? These are all open loops in your psyche, though often it takes deeper and more introspective processes to identify the bigger goals and subtler inclinations. There is magic in being in the present in your life. I'm always amazed at the power of clear observation simply about what's going on, what's true. Finding out the exact details of your personal finances, clarifying the historical data about the company you're buying, or getting the facts about who really said what to whom in an interpersonal conflict can be constructive, if not downright healing. Getting things done and feeling good about it means being willing to recognize, acknowledge, and appropriately manage all the things that have your consciousness engaged. Mastering the art of stress-free productivity requires it. Working from the bottom up. In order to create productive alignment in your life, you could quite reasonably start with a clarification from the top down. Decide why you're on the planet. Figure out what kind of life and work and lifestyle would best allow you to fulfill that contract. What kind of job and personal relationships would support that direction? What key things would you need to put in place and make happen right now? And what could you do physically as soon as possible to kickstart each of those? In truth, you can approach your priorities from any level, at any time. I always have something that I could do constructively to enhance my awareness and focus on each level. I'm never lacking in more visions to elaborate, goals to reassess, projects to identify or create, or actions to decide on. The trick is to learn to pay attention to the ones you need to at the appropriate time to keep you and your systems in balance. Because everything will ultimately be driven by the priorities of the level above it, any formulation of your priorities would obviously most efficiently begin at the top. For example, if you spend time prioritizing your work and then later discover that it's not the work you think you ought to be doing, you may have wasted time and energy that could have been better spent defining the next job you really want. The problem is that without a sense of control at the implementation levels, current projects and actions, and without inner trust in your own ability to manage those levels appropriately, trying to manage yourself from the top down often creates frustration. From a practical perspective, I suggest going from the bottom up instead. I've coached people from both directions, and in terms of lasting value, I can honestly say that getting someone in control of the details of his or her current physical world and then elevating the focus from there has never missed. The primary reason to work from this bottom-up direction is that it clears the psychic decks to begin with, allowing your creative attention to focus on the more meaningful and elusive visions that you may need to challenge yourself to identify. Also, this particular method has a high degree of flexibility and freedom, and it includes a thinking and organizing practice that is universal and effective no matter what it's focused on. That makes it worth learning, no matter what the actual content you're dealing with at the moment may be. Change your mind, and this process will help you adjust with maximum speed. And knowing that you have that ability will give you permission to play a bigger game. It's truly empowering. While the 50,000-foot level is obviously the most important context within which to set priorities, experience has shown me that when we understand and implement all the levels of work in which we are engaged, especially the runway and 10,000-foot levels, we gain greater freedom and resources to do the bigger work that we're all about. Although a bottom-up approach is not a key conceptual priority, from a practical perspective, it's a critical factor in achieving a balanced, productive, and comfortable life. Trying to manage from the top down when the bottom is out of control may be the least effective approach. Runway. The first thing to do is make sure your action lists are complete, which in itself can be quite a task. Those who focus on gathering and objectifying all of those items discover that there are many they've forgotten, misplaced, or just not recognized. Aside from your calendar, if you don't have at least 50 next actions and waiting fors, including all the agendas for people and meetings, I would be skeptical about whether you really had all of them. If you've followed through rigorously with the steps and suggestions in Part 2, though, you may have them already. If not, and you do want to get this level up to date, set aside some time to work through Chapters 4 through 6 in real implementation mode. When you've finished getting this level of control current, you'll automatically have a more grounded sense of immediate priorities, which is almost impossible to achieve otherwise. 10,000 feet. Finalize your projects list. Does it truly capture all the commitments you have that will require more than one action to get done? That will define the boundaries of the kind of week-to-week operational world you're in and allow you to relax your thinking for longer intervals. If you make a complete list of all the things you want to have happen in your life and work at this level, you'll discover that there are actions you need to do that you hadn't realized. Just creating this objective inventory will give you a firmer basis on which to make decisions about what to do when you have discretionary time. Invariably, when people get their projects list up to date, they discover there are several things that could be done readily to move things they care about forward. Very few people have this clear data defined and available to themselves in some objective form. Before any discussion about what should be done this afternoon can take place, this information must be at hand. Again, if you've been putting into practice the methodology of getting things done, your projects list will be where it needs to be. For most of our coaching clients, it takes 10 to 15 hours of collecting, processing, and organizing to get to the point of trusting the thoroughness of their inventory. 20,000 feet. This is the level of current job responsibilities. What are the hats you wear? Professionally, this would relate to your current position and work. Personally, it would include the roles you've taken on in your family, in your community, and of course, with yourself as a functioning person. You may have some of these roles already defined and written out. If you've recently taken a new position and there's an agreement or contract about your areas of responsibility, that would certainly be a good start. If you've done any kind of personal goal setting and values clarifying exercises in the past and still have any materials you created then, add those to the mix. Next, I recommend that you make and keep a list called Areas of Focus. You might like to separate this into professional and personal sublists, in which case you'll want to use them both equally for a consistent review. This is one of the most useful checklists you can create for your own self-management. It won't require the kind of once-a-week recalibration that the projects list will. More likely, it will have meaning on a longer recursion cycle. Depending on the speed of change in some of the more important areas of your life and work, this should be used as a trigger for potential new projects every 1 to 3 months. You probably have somewhere between 4 and 7 key areas of responsibility in your work, and a similar number personally. Your job may include things like staff development, systems design, long-range planning, administrative support, marketing, and scheduling, or responsibility for facilities, fulfillment, quality control, asset management, and so on. If you're your own business, your attention will be on many more areas than if you have a very specialized function in a large organization. The rest of your life might entail areas of focus such as parenting, partnering, church, health, community service, home management, financial management, self-development, creative expression, and so forth. The operational purpose of the areas of focus list is to ensure that you have all your projects and next actions defined so you can manage your responsibilities appropriately. If you were to create an accounting of those and evaluate them objectively, in terms of what you're doing and should be doing, you'll undoubtedly uncover projects you need to add to your projects list. You may, in reviewing the list, decide that some areas are just fine and are being taken care of. Then again, you may realize that something has been bugging you in one area and that a project should be created to shore it up. Areas of focus is really just a more abstract and refined version of the triggers list we covered earlier. Every client I've coached in the last 20 years has uncovered at least one important gap at this level of discussion. For instance, a common hat a manager or executive wears is staff development. Upon reflection, most realize they need to add a project or two in that area, such as upgrade our performance review process. A discussion of priorities would have to incorporate all of these levels of current agreements between yourself and others. If you get this job description checklist in play and keep it current, you'll probably be more relaxed and in control than most people in our culture. It will certainly go a long way toward moving you from hope to trust as you make the necessary on-the-run choices about what to do. 30,000 to 50,000 plus feet. Whereas the three lower levels have mostly to do with the current state of things, your actions, projects, and areas of responsibility, from here up, the factors of the future and your direction and intentions are primary. There is still an inventory to take at these plateaus, but it's more about what is true right now about where I've decided I'm going and how I'm going to get there. This can range from one-year goals in your job, 30,000 feet, to a three-year vision for your career and personal net worth, 40,000 feet, to intuiting your life purpose and how to maximize its expression, 50,000 plus feet. I'm blending the three uppermost levels together here because situations often can't easily be pigeonholed into one or another of these categories. Also, since getting things done is more about the art of implementation than about how to define goals and vision, I won't offer a rigorous examination here. But by its very nature, this investigation can broach potentially deep and complex arenas, which could include business strategy, organization development, career planning, and life direction and values. For our purposes, the focus is on capturing what motivators exist for you in current reality that determine the inventory of what your work actually is right now. Whether your directions and goals should be changed, based on deeper thinking, analysis, and intuition, could be another discussion. Even so, there are probably some things you can identify right now that can help you get current in your own thinking about your work and what's important in it. If you were to intuitively frame a picture of what you think you might be doing 12 to 18 months from now, or what the nature of your job will look like at that point, what would that trigger? At this level, which is subtler, there may be things personally you need to let go of and people and systems that may need to be developed to allow the transition. And as the job itself is a moving target, given the shifting sands of the professional world these days, there may need to be projects defined to ensure viability of the outputs in your area. In the personal arena, this is where you would want to consider things like, my career is going to stagnate unless I assert my own goals more specifically to my boss or my boss's boss, or what new things are my children going to be doing next year and what do I need to do differently because of that, or what preparation do I need to ensure that I can deal with this health problem we've just uncovered. Through a longer scope, you might assess, how is your career going? How is your personal life moving along? What is your organization doing relative to changes in the environment? And what impact does that have on you? These are the 1 to 5 year horizon questions that, when I ask them, elicit different and important kinds of answers from everyone. Not long ago, I coached someone in a large international bank who, after a few months of implementing this methodology and getting control of his day-to-day inventory of work, decided the time was right to invest in his own startup high-tech firm. The thought had been too intimidating for him to address initially, but working from the runway level up made it much more accessible and a natural consequence of thinking at this horizon. If you're involved in anything that has a future of longer than a year, marriage, kids, a career, a company, an art form, you would do well to think about what you might need to be doing to manage things along that vector. Questions to ask yourself here are, what are the longer-term goals and objectives in my organization? And what projects do I need to have in place relative to them to fulfill my responsibilities? What longer-term goals and objectives have I set for myself? And what projects do I need to have in place to make them happen? What other significant things are happening that could affect my options about what I'm doing? Here are some examples of the kinds of issues that show up at this level of conversation. First, the changing nature of your job, given the shifting priorities of the company. Instead of managing the production of your own training programs in-house, you're going to outsource them to vendors. Or, the direction in which you feel you need to move in your career. You see yourself doing a different kind of job a year from now, and you need to make a transition out of the one you have while exploring the options for a transfer or promotion. Or, the organization direction, given globalization and expansion. You see a lot of major international travel looming on the horizon for you, and given your lifestyle preferences, you need to consider how to readjust your career plans. Or, lifestyle preferences and changing needs. As your kids get older, your need to be at home with them is diminishing, and your interest in investment and retirement planning is growing. At the topmost level of thinking, you'll need to ask some of the ultimate questions. Why does your company exist? Why do you exist? What is the core DNA of your existence personally and/or organizationally that drives your choices? This is the big picture stuff with which hundreds of books and gurus and models are devoted to helping you grapple. Why? This is the great question with which we all struggle. You can have all the other levels of your life and work shipshape, defined, and organized to a T. Still, if you're the slightest bit off course in terms of what at the deepest level you want, or are called to be doing, you're going to be uncomfortable. Getting priority thinking off your mind. Take at least a few minutes, if you haven't already done so, to jot down some informal notes about things that occurred to you while you've been listening to this chapter. Whatever popped into your mind at these more elevated levels of your inner radar, write it down and get it out of your head. Then process those notes. Decide whether what you wrote down is something you really want to move on or not. If not, throw the note away or put it on a someday maybe list or in a folder called Dreams and Goals I Might Get Around to at Some Point. Perhaps you want to continue accumulating more of this kind of future thinking and would like to do the exercise with more formality. For example, by drafting a new business plan with your partners, designing and writing out your idea of a dream life with your spouse, creating a more specific career map for the next 3 years for yourself, or just getting a personal coach who can lead you through those discussions and thought processes. If so, put that outcome on your projects list and decide the next action. Then do it, hand it off to get done, or put the action reminder on the appropriate list. With that done, You may want to turn your focus to developmental thinking about specific projects that have been identified but not fleshed out as fully as you'd like. You'll want to ensure that you're set up for that kind of vertical processing. Chapter 10. Getting Projects Under Control. Chapters 4 through 9 have given you all the tricks and methods you need to clear your head and make intuitive choices about what to do when. That's the horizontal level, what needs your attention and action across the horizontal landscape of your life. The last piece of the puzzle is the vertical level, the digging deep and pie-in-the-sky thinking that can leverage your creative brain power. That gets us back to refining and energizing our project planning. The need for more informal planning. After years of working with thousands of professionals down in the trenches, I can safely say that virtually all of us could be doing more planning more informally and more often about our projects and our lives. And if we did, it would relieve a lot of pressure on our psyches and produce an enormous amount of creative output with minimal effort. I've discovered that the biggest improvement opportunity in planning does not consist of techniques for the highly elaborate and complex kind of project organizing that professional project managers sometimes use, like Gantt charts. Most of the people who need those already have them, or at least have access to the training and software required to learn about them. The real need is to capture and utilize more of the creative, proactive thinking we do, or could do. The major reason for the lack of this kind of effective value-added thinking is the dearth of systems for managing the potentially infinite amount of detail that could show up as a result. This is why my approach tends to be bottom-up. If you feel out of control with your current actionable commitments, you'll resist focused planning. An unconscious pushback occurs. As you begin to apply these methods, however, you may find that they free up enormous creative and constructive thinking. If you have systems and habits ready to leverage your ideas, your productivity can expand exponentially. In Chapter 3, I covered in some detail the five phases of project planning that take something from the idea stage into physical reality. What follows is a compilation of practical tips and techniques to facilitate the natural informal planning processes I recommend. Although these suggestions are all based on common sense, they're not followed nearly as frequently as they could be. Put them to use whenever and as often as you can, instead of saving up your thinking for big formal meetings. Which projects should you be planning? Most of the outcomes you've identified for your projects list will not need any kind of front-end planning other than the sort you need to do in your head quickly and naturally to come up with the next action on them. The only planning needed for get car inspected, for example, would be to decide to check the phone book for the nearest inspection location and call and set up a time. There are two types of projects, however, that deserve at least some sort of planning activity. First, those that still have your attention even after you've determined their next actions. And second, those about which potentially useful ideas and supportive detail just show up. The first type, the projects that you know have other things about them that must be decided on and organized, will need a more detailed approach than just identifying a next action. For these, you'll need a more specific application of one or more of the other four phases of the natural planning model: purpose and principles, vision, outcome, brainstorming, and/or organizing. The second type, the projects for which ideas just show up, ad hoc, on a beach or in a car or in a meeting, need to have an appropriate place into which these associated ideas can be captured. Then they can reside there for later use as needed. Projects that need next actions about planning. There are probably a few projects you can think of right now, off the top of your head, that you know you want to get more objectified, fleshed out, and under control. Perhaps you have an important meeting coming up and you know you have to prepare an agenda and materials for it. Or you've just inherited the job of coordinating the annual associates conference and you've got to get it organized as soon as possible so you can start delegating significant pieces. Or you've got to clarify a job description for a new position on your team to give to human resources. If you haven't done it already, get a next action now that will start the planning process for each of these and put it on the appropriate action list. Then proceed with further planning steps. Typical planning steps. The most common types of planning-oriented actions will be your own brainstorming and organizing, setting up meetings, and gathering information. Brainstorming. Some of the projects that have your attention right now will require you to do your own free-form thinking. This is especially true for those for which you're not clear about what the next action would be when you made that decision. These should all have a next action, such as draft ideas Ray X. You need to decide where and how you want to do that action in order to know which action list to put it on. Do you do this kind of thinking best on a computer or by handwriting your thoughts on paper? I may choose either medium depending on what my intuition tells me. For me, this next action would go either on my at computer list or on anywhere, because I can draw mind maps wherever I am as long as I have pen and paper. Organizing. You may have some projects for which you have already collected notes and miscellaneous support materials, and you just need to sort through them and get them into more structured form. In this case, your next action would likely be organize Project X notes. If you have to be in your office to do that, because that's where the files are and you don't want to carry them around, that action should go on your at office action list. If you're carrying the project notes around with you, in a folder or in a portable organizer or on a laptop, then the organize action would go on an anywhere or miscellaneous action list if you're going to do it by hand, or on at computer if you're going to use a word processor, outliner, or project planning software. Setting up meetings. Often, progress will be made on project thinking when you set up a meeting with the people you'd like to have involved in the brainstorming. That usually means sending an email to the whole group or to an assistant to get it calendared, or making a phone call to the first person to nail down a time. Gathering information. Sometimes the next task on project thinking is to gather more data. Maybe you need to talk to someone to get his or her input, call Bill Ray his thoughts on the manager's meeting, or you need to look through the files you just inherited from last year's conference, review associate conference archive files. Or you want to surf the web to get a sense of what's happening out there on a new topic you're exploring, R&D search firms for sales executives. Random project thinking. Don't lose any ideas about projects that could potentially be useful. Many times you'll think of something you don't want to forget when you're in a place that has nothing to do with the project. You're driving to the store, for example, and you think of a great way that you might want to start off the next staff meeting. Or you're stirring the spaghetti sauce in the kitchen, and it occurs to you that you might want to give out nice tote bags to participants in the upcoming conference. Or you're watching the evening news when you suddenly remember another key person you might want to include in the advisory council you're putting together. If these aren't specifically next actions that can go directly on your action list, you'll still need to capture and organize them somewhere that makes sense. Of course, the most critical tools for ensuring that nothing gets lost is your collection system, your in-basket pad and paper or equivalents at work and at home, and in a portable version, an index card, while you're out and about. You need to hold all your ideas until you later decide what to do with them. Tools and structures that support project thinking. No matter at what level project ideas show up, it's great to have good tools always at hand for capturing them as they occur. Once they've been captured, it's useful to have access to them whenever you need to refer to them. Thinking tools. One of the great secrets to getting ideas and increasing your productivity is utilizing the function follows form phenomenon. Great tools can trigger good thinking. I've come up with some of my most productive thoughts when playing with my organizer in an airport waiting for a flight. If you aren't writing anything down, it's extremely difficult to stay focused on anything for more than a few minutes, especially if you're by yourself. But when you utilize physical tools to keep your thinking anchored, you can stay engaged constructively for hours. Writing instruments. Keep good writing tools around all the time so you never have any unconscious resistance to thinking due to not having anything to capture it with. If I don't have something to write with, I can sense that I'm not as comfortable letting myself think about projects and situations. Conversely, I've done some great thinking and planning at times just because I wanted to use my nice-looking, smooth-writing ballpoint pen. You may not be inspired by cool gear like I am, but if you are, do yourself a favor and invest in quality writing tools. I also suggest that you keep nice ballpoint pens at the stations where you're likely to want to take notes, particularly near phones around your house. Paper and pads. In addition to writing tools, you should always have functional pads of paper close at hand. Legal pads work well because you can easily tear off pages with ideas and notes and toss them into your in-basket until you get a good chance to process them. Also, you'll often want to keep some of your informal mind maps, and you can put those separate pieces of paper in appropriate file folders without having to rewrite them. Easels and whiteboards. If you have room for them, whiteboards and/or easel pads are very functional thinking tools to use from time to time. They give you plenty of space on which to jot down ideas, and it can be useful to keep them in front of you for a while as you incubate on a topic. Whiteboards are great to have on a wall in your office and in meeting rooms, and the bigger the better. If you have children, I recommend you install one in their bedrooms. I wish I'd grown up with the encouragement to have as many ideas as I could. Be sure to keep plenty of fresh markers on hand. It's frustrating to want to start writing on a whiteboard and find that all the markers are dry and useless. Whenever two or more people are gathered for a meeting, someone should start writing somewhere where the others can see. Even if you erase your thoughts after a few minutes, just the act of writing them down facilitates a constructive thinking process like nothing else. I found it immensely helpful at times to draw informal diagrams and notes on paper tablecloths, placemats, or even napkins in restaurants if I didn't have my own pad of paper at hand. The computer. Many times I like to think on my laptop and my word processor. There are so many things I might want to do later on with my thinking, and it feels terrific to already have it in some digital form for later editing and cutting and pasting into various other applications. Once I boot it up and the screen is ready in front of me, I find that thinking just automatically starts to happen. This is another good reason to ensure that your typing and keyboard skills are sufficient to make engaging with the computer at least easy, if not downright fun. The support structures. In addition to good tools ubiquitously at hand, it is productive to have accessible formats into which project thinking can be captured. Much as a pen and paper in front of you supports brainstorming, having good tools and places for organizing project details facilitates the more linear planning that many projects need. Create file folders or loose leaf pages as needed. A good general reference filing system, right at hand and easy to use, is not only critical to manage the general workflow process, but highly functional for project thinking as well. Often, a project begins to emerge when it's triggered by relevant data, notes, and miscellaneous materials, and for this reason, you'll want to create a folder for a topic as soon as you have something to put in it. If your filing system is too formal or non-existent, you'll probably miss many opportunities to generate a project focus sufficiently early. As soon as you return from that first meeting with your initial notes about a topic that has just emerged on the horizon, create a file and store them in it right away, after you have gleaned any next actions, of course. Many times, in coaching clients, I find that the mere act of creating a file for a topic into which we can organize random notes and potentially relevant materials gives them a significantly improved sense of control. It's a way of physically, visibly, and psychologically getting their arms around it. If you like to work with a loose-leaf notebook or planner, it's good to keep an inventory of fresh notepaper or graph paper that you can use to set up a page on a theme or project as it shows up. While some projects may later deserve a whole tabbed section or even an entire notebook of their own, they don't start out that way. And most of your projects may need only a page or two to hold the few ideas you need to track. Software tools. Software is in one sense a dark black hole to explore in search of good project management tools. For the most part, the applications that are specifically designed for project organizing are way too complex with too much horsepower to really be functional for 98% of what most people need to manage. They're appropriate only for the very small percentage of the professional world that actually needs them. The rest of us usually find bits and pieces of applications more informal and project-friendly. As I've noted, I've never seen any two projects that needed the same amount of detailing and structure to get them under control. So it would be difficult to create any one application that would suffice for the majority. Digital outlining. Most of what anyone needs to structure his or her thinking about projects can be found in any kind of application that has a simple hierarchical outlining function. I used to use a Symantec program called GrandView, and now I often use Microsoft Word for just this kind of project planning. A piece of a digital outline I created for one of our own planning sessions could be seen in the PDF file included with this program. The great thing about outlining applications is that they can be as complex or as simple as required. There are numerous software programs that provide this kind of basic hierarchical structuring. The trick is to find one that you feel comfortable with so you can rapidly get familiar with how to insert headings and subheadings and move them around as needed. Until you can stop focusing on how to use the program, you'll resist booting it up and using it to think and organize. It doesn't really matter where you put this kind of thinking, so long as it's easily accessible so you can input and review it as needed. Brainstorming applications. Several applications have been developed specifically to facilitate the brainstorming process. I currently